Ghoulish greetings, everyone. Those tunes are courtesy of the amazing country legend, my friend Bobby Mackey, and the amazing band that is Alien Manor.
Way back in the 30s, in the little town of Wilder, lived an old man and his lovely little daughter. They ran gambling for a living. It was the best place around. All the men would come and lay their money down. For Daddy was a jealous man, but Johanna fell in love. He kept seeing the man dealt a bad hand. So deep in the night, when all the world was quiet, someone came and took her lover's life.
Thanks for stopping by and making Paranormal Prowlers Podcast part of your morning, day, night, graveyard shift, whenever you listen and wherever you are listening from the Arctic Circle to the Bermuda Triangle, from the city of New York to the city of angels, far and wide, or near and close, it's absolutely appreciated.
Round of applause. This week's city shout-out goes to
Kirkland, Washington. Yes, Romania. Niagara Falls, Canada, Lakewood, Colorado, Gasparillo, Trinidad and Tobago, and Corby, England. Definitely need your passport for this one, my friends. We find ourselves doing time at Brushy Mountain State Penitentiary, nestled in the mountains of Patros, Tennessee. This historic location opens its doors in 1896, 4 years after the Coal Creek War comes to an abrupt end. Brushy, sometimes referred to as Bloody Brushy, was a maximum security prison. January 1st of 1896, over 200 prisoners arrive, making them the first, but certainly not the last, inmates to call this place home. In 1972, they shut down temporarily due to a prison guard strike. You know, they had enough bullshit, and they were sick and tired of being forced to work in what they considered to be unsafe conditions. Now, this lasted quite a while. It wasn't just, like, closed for a few months or something. Brushy was actually shut down for 4 years. That's a presidential seat right there, you know? So it's like, whoa, okay. They wouldn't open their doors up until 1976. Big ouch, baby. Big ouch indeed. Now, eventually, they closed their doors for that final time. When it comes to being in an active prison, at least in 2009. Now, mentioned earlier was the Coal Creek War. RealAppalachia.com gives more information about this conflict. Quote, "The Coal Creek War was a major labor uprising in the 1890s that erupted in the coal mining communities of East Tennessee. Rooted in the struggle between coal miners and mine operators, it pitted miners against a system that used convict labor to break strikes and drive down wages. Centered around Coal Creek, now Lake City, Tennessee, the conflict lasted from 1891 to 1893 and highlighted the tensions of the time, workers' rights, the abuses of the convict lease system, and the role of industrial capitalism in shaping lives and communities. In the 19th century, Tennessee, like many southern states, used a convict lease system to cut costs and generate revenue. Convicts were leased to private industries, like mining, where they worked under brutal, dangerous conditions for little to no pay. For mine operators, convict labor was cheap and easy to control, making it an attractive way to suppress labor costs. This practice became widespread in Tennessee and infuriated free miners, who felt it unfairly threatened their jobs and worsened their already challenging working conditions. In 1891, the situation reached a boiling point. Miners in Anderson and Campbell counties had endured poor wages and dangerous conditions for years. Many miners and their families lived in company-owned housing and bought goods at company-owned stores, keeping them locked in a cycle of debt. When mine operators brought in convict laborers to break strikes and keep wages low, miners realized their livelihoods were directly threatened. They argued that the use of convict labor created an unfair advantage for mine owners and left free workers without the power to demand fair treatment. Tensions peaked in July 1891 when miners at the Briceville mines organized against the use of convict labor. The miners tried legal petitions, appeals, and protests, but their pleas fell on deaf ears. Unquote. So they would take over the state prison, releasing very dangerous inmates, and it was a mess. The end result would see several hundred, over 500, to be arrested, and 27 killed. Oh boy. Those jailhouse blues, baby. Oops, he certainly did it again. The master of escapes, James Earl Ray. You've heard from him, about him, a few times on this podcast. Martin Luther King Jr.'s murderer, along with six other fellow inmates, escaped via scaling the fence. While I'm unsure about the other six men, I did find that James Earl Ray was a free man for, about 2.5 days. They found him 8.5 miles away up in the mountains, throwing his ass back in the slammer, baby. Yes. Now, like all prisons, many dangerous men called Brushy Mountain home. We know, of course, due to his escape, that James Earl Ray spent time here, among other fine establishments across the states, may I add. One man who was held here was named Paul Dennis Reed. He was a serial killer, better known as the fast food killer. And in 1997, between the months of February and April, he would murder 7 people. That's a lot of people in a short amount of time, for sure. Now, during this time, while he was busy serial killing it up, he was actually on parole due to an aggravated armed robbery at a steakhouse located in Houston, Texas. Now, that for that little stunt, he would serve 7 years in what really was supposed to be a 20-year sentence. I'll never understand that kind of thing. Like, you're given 20 years, but okay, you're not even going to do half of that. Can you imagine if he had served that full-term sentence? At least 7 people would still be alive. What this dude had against restaurants, who knows? But first the robbery at the steakhouse and then the murders that he would commit at the other establishments, it's just beyond weird. February 16th, 1997, Nashville. Before Captain D's opened their doors for the workday, a man shows up, acting like he's just some ordinary Joe in search of a job. He's reliable, he's committed, he's a good worker, yada, 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 yada. That's music to a lot of businesses' ears, right? So they let him in, and this will be the last thing that they ever do. Once he is in Captain D's, he forces the people, the 2 people that are there, a 16-year-old employee named Sarah, and the restaurant's manager, a gentleman named Steve, into the restaurant's walk-in freezer area. And the man demands that they lay down. He then proceeds to shoot them execution style. He then takes what money he can find and he flees the area. He will use that money as a down payment to buy a car. March 23rd, 1997, Nashville, McDonald's. Just 5 weeks after the Captain D's double murders, and less than 4 miles away from where Sarah and Steve, their lives abruptly ending, Paul is now at McDonald's waiting to make his next move. He waits until they close for the night, and he rushes the four employees who were probably happy the workday was finally over and can finally go home and hit the sack. No such luck, though. The budding serial killer forces them back into McDonald's, where he shoots three of the four dead, execution style. The victims, well, one was a woman, 17-year-old Andrea, and two men, 23-year-old Robert and 27-year-old Ronald. He attempts to shoot the fourth employee, a gentleman named Jose Gonzalez, but his gun malfunctions, thank God. And Gonzalez knows he is in the fight for his life and will not just stand there and wait to see what happens next. Jose and the man who just killed his three friends and co-workers fight. But besides a gun, Paul had a knife and uses that knife, stabbing Jose repeatedly, 17 times. And when Paul leaves after taking $3,000, well, today that's equivalent to a little over $6,000, he truly believes that he just killed four people, leaving no survivors, no witnesses behind. Jose, though, he was a fierce fighter, and even though he was stabbed 17 times, he was alive. But he was smart, and he plays dead. Once he heard the door shut and no sounds, no movement, no nothing, he makes his way to a phone and calls 911. He was sent to a hospital, and he would survive. And Jose would live on to testify against this monster. Thank God. April 23rd, 1997, Clarksville, Tennessee. Exactly 1 month after the triple murder and attempted murder of Jose, Baskin-Robbins is closed for the night. But somehow, in some way, Reed talks his way into the closest establishment, maybe pretending he was wanting a job like he did with Captain D's a couple months earlier. Who knows, right? Now, before, in his past crimes anyways, he would commit the murders right then and there at the restaurant, leaving them behind. And he would shoot them. Besides Jose, of course. But this one would be different. He takes his two victims, Angela, 21, and Michelle, 16, out of Baskin-Robbins. He kidnaps them, takes them to Dunbar Cave State Park, and he proceeds to slash their throats. Did he do this final one like this to throw off the authorities, making it seem like it was not connected to the murders at Captain D's and McDonald's? Or maybe he didn't want a repeat of what took place at McDonald's. But I don't know. Why take them away? I just don't understand. I don't understand why he did any of this, obviously. But, you know, investigators, they were hard at work and had multiple murders they were trying to solve. The public was absolutely terrified, no doubt about it. And, I mean, who could blame them, right? So it was a nightmare, obviously. And thankfully, this idiot, this monster, left behind evidence. And that evidence includes from his first victims, Steve from Captain D's. His license and video rental card belonging to him were discovered in East Nashville. Paul's fingerprints were found on both of those items. This sealed his fate for those two specific murders, Steve and Sarah, from Captain D's. And when it came to McDonald's victims, there was DNA evidence in his car that was linked directly to those murders, Andrea, Robert, and Ronald, and the attempted murder of Jose. Paul Dennis Reed was handed 7 death sentences. Of course, you have your anti-death penalty people and his family begging for his life to be spared. Oh, poor baby. Oh, what, like he spared their lives? When he shot those 5 people to death? When he slashed those 2 people's throats? And like he tried his hardest to kill Jose Gonzalez by stabbing him 17 fucking times? Please, I'm sorry, but just absolutely insane. They claimed that Paul was mentally unstable and had issues. Well, no shit. You go murder several people. Of course, not everything is going to be copacetic upstairs. But guess what? Let's be honest here. There are a lot of people out there that deal with mental illnesses. And my heart goes out to them. But guess what? Many of those people, a huge percentage of those people, don't go out and brutally murder other people. But what makes his life more precious than those that he wiped from this earth? He didn't spare their lives. Why does he deserve to live? Now, sadly, this bullshit actually works, and he is not executed. Believe me, there were dates that were set, execution dates, right? But there was always a stay of execution. He would die, but due to natural causes. Something, mind you, he robbed any of his victims, besides Jose, to do themselves. Die a natural death. With serial killers, there's always that question. Are there more victims that we do not know about? Possibly. It's believed he was possibly connected to the infamous Brown's Chicken Massacre in Illinois, a horrific event that left 7 Brown's Chicken employees dead. I remember watching a documentary on that, I think on Investigation Discovery, and oh, it was just bone-chilling, heartbreaking. 7 people dead in a short amount of time, one night. He also was on their radar for 3 murders in Houston. Remember, Houston is also where he robbed that steakhouse. A man named Max Sofar was doing time for that crime, and he died while awaiting execution while on death row. It wasn't all bad guys that called this place home. Tourbrushy.com gives more information. Quote, one day back in the early 70s, a young deer fell off of the cliff into the yard here at Brushy. The inmates decided to keep the deer as sort of a pet and named the deer Geronimo on account of how it came to be in the prison. Geronimo was tamed and liked to chew on unlit cigarettes. When labor disputes shut down Brushy from 72 to 75, the inmates were moved to Nashville, but Geronimo stayed behind, with its future uncertain. The inmates voted to move Geronimo to Nashville's prison. The state paid to move the deer to Nashville with its friends, but Geronimo had trouble adjusting to life away from Brushy Mountain. The Nashville warden said the deer threw temper tantrums. One inmate's face was nicked by the deer and required stitches. When the prisoner was taken to the hospital for medical attention, he briefly escaped. Geronimo's days behind bars ended when the animal broke its leg and the limb had to be amputated. Newspaper reports don't specify where the deer spent the rest of its life, but Geronimo still lives on in the hearts of inmates and guards who cared for it. Unquote. So I think that's really sweet that they actually were there to help the deer, Geronimo. Take care of it, love it, feed it, have some sort of responsibility. Like, you know, you're doing time, you did the crime, but guess what? There's something that you can do that makes you feel good that you're doing something right, that you're helping somebody, helping something, some creature. And so I kind of like that. So people here, guests and staff alike, have heard disembodied voices. Cold spots have indeed been felt here. The apparition of James Earl Ray has been seen here many a time, wandering the area. Brushy Mountain has been investigated and featured on TV shows like Ghost Hunters and Ghost Adventures. Now, I found further information and details on Amy's Crypt. I gotta say, that gal sure is a world traveler and stays busy hitting up all of these phenomenally awesome haunted locations. Check her stuff out sometime. Just look up Amy's Crypt and you can see all these places that she has adventured off to. And I quote Amy's Crypt. Previous inmates, guards, visitors, and current staff at the former prison have all claimed to have unexplainable experiences within the old Brushy Mountain prison. They have seen, heard, felt, and even smelt things that are so out of place. They must be deemed paranormal. Visual phenomena is said to be extremely common. Many to walk the halls of the prison at night have sighted shadowy figures lurking, while others have spotted apparitions that resemble people. Then there are a select few who have sighted entities that do not seem to be of a human origin, such as one who seems to creep along the floors, and another that has been described as part goat and similar to a man, yet who has cloven hooves. Noises are very common too, with lots of reports of voices, doors slamming, and footsteps when no one is around existing. Then there are the scariest reports of all, those of physical attacks. A number of people have been touched, scratched, choked, or even made to feel physically sick within the Brushy Mountain prison, unquote. Now that is always kind of unnerving for sure. It's one thing if you're investigating and you're getting EVPs and hearing sounds and catching video and photographic evidence, but it's a totally other ball game when you are actually being physically touched by a spirit. Been there, done that. It's a neat feeling at times, but then when they're attacking you, if you're being pushed or shoved or scratched or other types of things, and in this case, like Amy mentioned, choked, that's straight up bone chilling and terrifying for sure. So in 2018, Brushy opened its doors once more, this time not as an active prison, but to the public for tours and concerts. And you know, there's a lot going on over here at Brushy, as it is home to a distillery where they have their own moonshine, my favorite whiskey, and vodka. Also home to the Warden's Table Restaurant, where they serve killer, no pun intended, barbecue. That's like right up my alley, man. I would love to check out the distillery and the Warden's Table anyways. So it's like, even if you're not all into the paranormal, that's still a really cool place to go to. It's a little bit of something for everybody, for sure. And I once again quote tourbrushy.com. Jamie Brock is the Brushy's lead paranormal investigator. Jamie was born and raised in Petros, Tennessee, the home of the Brushy Mountain State Penitentiary. Jamie has investigated the paranormal for more than 20 years, focusing her efforts on Brushy after its closing in 2009. Her devotion to Brushy and its past encompass many years of investigation into the history of the property which she has family ties to. Jamie focuses her paranormal contact on obtaining firm evidence utilizing many techniques and specialized equipment. She has had documented contact utilizing a wide variety of equipment, obtaining evidence with the latest proven instruments such as an Ovilus 5, REM pod, EDI box, SLS camera, K2 meters, mag light, grid lights, multiple voice recorders, and her favorite, dowsing rods. Jamie also conducts daytime group tours, special flashlight tours, and has assisted with TV shows and YouTube programs utilizing the grounds and facility, unquote. They are known as End of the Line Paranormal, and they offer tours, two different types of paranormal tours actually, the 4-hour standard investigation and the 7-hour overnight investigation. This is straight from their site. Standard paranormal investigation, which can have up to 6 people, is $480. And if there is 6 of you, again, this could be up to 6 people, that's just $80 a person, so that's awesome. And an overnight investigation for up to 12 people, and if there is 12 people, it runs each person $125. So get a group of friends together, plan this shit, do it, get some evidence, and then tell me all about it. I'd love to hear it. paraprowl@gmail.com. Now, from April to May, they are open Thursday to Sunday from 10:30 to 6:30 p.m. June to August, they are open those same hours, but on a daily basis. September and October are identical to April and May's Thursday through Sunday, same hours all the way around, guys. And November leaves you with Saturday and Sunday, 10:30 to 5:30. And December 1st through March 31st, they are closed, but still open, I believe, for paranormal tours. So in my opinion, that means they're still open. So maybe that just means that the restaurant and distillery are closed during that time. I'm unsure. You might want to call and check ahead about that. But again, December 1st through March 31st, they will be closed. Like, you know, whatever will be closed there. So your time is running out. If you want to go before they shut down for their little season, be sure to do that now, as we are in mid-November, my friends. Mm-hmm. So again, be sure to check out this historical location. It's been on my bucket list for a long time. And again, if you're not a paranormal fan, that's okay. If you're a history buff, check it out. This place is a very historical location. They have phenomenal grub, I've heard, and the booze and spirits, no pun intended. So come on over.
And that concludes another fantastic podcast. Legend has it, if you don't tune in, I'll be returning to haunt you. So make sure to tune in for the next episode.
Did you enjoy this week's episode? Listen to the others. They are all phenomenal. Haven't heard every single damn one yet? No need to fret, lose any sleep over, or cry. Just hit up any of those podcast platforms now, such as Google Podcasts, Apple Podcasts, Podcast Republic, Deezer, Spotify, Player FM. Basically, wherever you may roam to hear your other spooky podcasts, you'll probably find Paranormal Brothers Podcast lurking in the background. Thanks, everyone, and I will
see you next week.